യോഗേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം മലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദ്യകേന യോപാകരോത്തം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാനതോസ്മി സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ച മുനിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ ക്രമാത് വിവരണസ്യ ച. So we are continuing the discussion, the last part of the discussion on this 18th sutra, Virama Pratyabhyasa Purvaka Samskara Seshaha Anyaha. You know, we are discussing, continuing the discussion of Swami Vivekananda's exposition. Swamiji is asking one question. What is the result of constant practice of this higher concentration? All old tendencies of restlessness and dullness will be destroyed, as well as the tendencies of goodness too. So that is something we have to take notice of. Good tendencies and bad tendencies, one should be able to transcend the good also. That is an important aspect of both Vedanta and Yoga. And he gives an example. Even good tendencies are not enough. The advantage of good tendencies is that they neutralize the effects of bad tendencies. But they do not liberate us from the problem of tendencies emerging in the mental system. So it becomes clear in course of this discussion. The case is similar to that of the chemicals used to take the dirt and alloy of gold. So maybe in those days, you know, gold had to be extracted. And for that, they had to use some chemicals. And once that extraction is completed, even what is used to extract the chemicals also should be removed if you want gold. So the mind should reach a state where the waverings and vrittis, impressions and samskaras completely get undone, where the mind is able to transcend vritti. So transcending is an important point to remember. When you want to transcend, you have to go beyond both. So there is a very interesting point that we should remember here. In Yoga and Vedanta, the concept of God is not an aggregate of all that is good. If you look upon God, let us say, as the totality of all the positive, meritorious things, quality, good qualities, then we have to find an answer for the reality of their opposite. So, as I mentioned several times earlier, in non-advaitic, non-dualistic systems, in Hindu tradition and also in mainstream Abrahamic traditions, God is often defined as the totality of all that is good, and then the explanation of the opposite of good is done by or through the process of anthropomorphization, as it is called. You give a human dimension to the totality of all that is bad. So in order to reach complete liberation, first we must get rid of all evil tendencies, bad tendencies, by developing good tendencies. And then we must be able to even go beyond good tendencies so that there is absolutely no possibility of bad tendencies ever emerging. So long as good-bad equation continues, you cannot have just one coin. You can't have a coin with only one side. A coin will have two sides. So how do you explain the unpleasantness, the undesirable experiences? How do we explain this? The easiest way to do that is, in Hindu monotheism and also in Abrahamic religions, is God has given all that is good and there is somebody else, devil, Satan, and he is the embodiment of all that is bad. So there is a constant warfare going on between God and the devil. So there you are admitting that God has a competitor there. So very often if you read Paradise Lost, Milton's Paradise Lost, you find there the Satan devil also is quite equally strong and equally efficient. Only he's sitting somewhere, standing somewhere to ambush those who are marching towards heaven. So he wants to tempt those souls to his camp. So this is true in many of the monotheistic traditions. It's a philosophical question. So in Vedanta, and you know, as I mentioned earlier, yoga finds its fulfillment not in yoga, but in Vedanta. So in Vedanta, on the other hand, you should be able to know, transcend not only bad, but also good to get complete freedom. Because so long as you are looking for everything that is good, there is always a possibility of something not so good emerging somewhere. So one should be able to look for something that transcends both. So Swami Vivekananda is giving an example of this. You know, to extract gold, you have to remove all the dirt and filth from the gold ore. And for that, you need chemicals. But those chemicals are necessary, no doubt, to remove the undesirable things so that you get gold. But then you don't keep those chemicals as you keep gold. Those chemicals are also to be removed. So I can give a very illustrative example from Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna was a great philosopher who lived the 6th century AD. Maybe a little earlier, maybe 4th century AD, according to some other historians. He is the most prominent teacher of Shunyavada, which has become very popular these days in this country, especially after the popularity of Buddhism, you know, from Mahayana tradition for Japan, China, Tibet, and other Mahayana countries. This Shunyavada as a great attractive philosophy entered American cultural and philosophical landscape after the 50s and 60s. So you find hundreds of titles dealing with the doctrine of emptiness, or the doctrine of the great void, as they call in English. And now, actually, the doctrine of the great void is deceptive, because Shunya does not mean emptiness or void as we define those words in Webster's dictionary or Oxford Learner's Dictionary. No, it is not absolute nothingness. It is the absolute indescribability. That is an important point, remember. So what Nagarjuna is trying to bring out in his famous, it's called the Bible of Shunyavada. It's called Madhyamika Karika, Moola Madhyama Shastram. It's a well-known book which he wrote in Sanskrit, this commentary by Chandrakirti. So Shunya is one absolute reality which is empirically indescribable, undefinable, which you cannot explain or describe or define at the empirical level. Because at the empirical level, when you describe something, you have to say, well, this glass is here, or this glass is not here, or this is a book, this is not a table. So you may explain or describe something either as this is or this is not, at the empirical level. So all that you experience and cognize and pursue at the intellectual level, you see mind and intellect and the five senses of perception, you try to understand and explain by saying is or is not. That's all. Two main categories of cognitive perception. Now, this cognition relates only to things of this world, of the phenomenal empirical experience. But Shunya, according to Nagarjuna, is trans-empirical. It is one transcendental, absolute reality which is non-dual. Even Nagarjuna says it's non-dual. And it is beyond description, beyond words, beyond definition. So Shunya in Sanskrit means, according to dictionary, it means empty or void. That's what it means. So very often this translation is made from Sanskrit in English as void or voidness or the great emptiness you find in English translations, which is terribly misleading. Nagarjuna would turn in his grave. Poor man died in 4th century AD. What it means is one indescribable, undefinable, absolute reality which you cannot explain in empirical terms. For that, one of the commentators of Nagarjuna's philosophy, his name is Chandragirti, who wrote a great commentary in Sanskrit on Madhyamika Karika, which is the Bible of Shunyavada, the doctrine of emptiness. It's the most prominent dogma of Mahayana Buddhism, which is popular in China, Japan, all these countries. So there's an illustration. Suppose you have a stomach problem. You have to take a medicine. Remember, many of these Buddhist philosophers are also great Ayurveda scholars. Many of the writers of Ayurveda texts like Ashtanga Hridaya was written by Vagbhadacharya. He was a great Buddhist, actually. Many of the Sanskrit grammarians and Ayurvedic teachers were all Buddhist. So in Ayurveda, I mean, this Chandrakirti takes one example from Ayurveda. Suppose you have a stomach problem. So there is a foreign body which you have to get rid of. So you take a medicine, some kind, maybe Ayurvedic root or whatever it is. Then he says, that helps you to cleanse your stomach. But then that root also should be removed. Otherwise, if it remains within the stomach, it will create greater problems. So he says, the root that you take, the medicine that you take to cleanse your stomach also finally should come out and the stomach should be emptied. So even to call Shunya as Shunya is wrong according to Nagarjuna Chandrakirti. If you define Shunya as Shunya, then you're defining it. If you define it, there's no more Shunya. So even an attempt to define the undefinable, to describe something which is beyond description, is logically, philosophically, epistemologically untenable. So he says, Shunya cannot even be called Shunya. Shunya is the definition of Shunya. Shunya. If you define it, then it's no more Shunya. Because when you define, you limit it. Their definition means you are creating a straitjacket. You are putting it within that mold. And then it's no more indescribable. So what this means is, even to explain God as the sum total or totality of all that is good is actually limiting God to our empirical level. So all good qualities have one great purpose. It removes all bad qualities. The example which I gave earlier, you know, suppose there is a piece of rope in the room which is not well lit, so you mistake the rope for a snake, for a stick, for a maybe for a thin stream of water or a crack on the floor. In the Sanskrit language, you know, sarpa, bhuchidra, jaladhara, and danta. You may mistake a piece of rope, curved rope, for a snake or a thin stream of water or maybe a curved stick or a crack on the floor. These are the possible. There are many other modern times, there are many several other examples can be given. Now, when you bring light, you realize that it is not snake, it is only rope. The fact that it is a rope doesn't depend upon your bringing light. Even if you do not bring light, the rope will not become snake. Then what happens? The light removed darkness, which was what caused your misunderstanding when you mistake the rope for a snake. So the role of the light is limited to removing darkness. And once darkness is gone, the rope becomes self-revealed. Similarly, when you get correct understanding, you get rid of wrong understanding. When you practice great spiritual values, you get rid of all undesirable tendencies from our mind. Our mind becomes filled with all good qualities. Then mind should ascend to a higher level when it transcends even good qualities. So that is the logic that Vivekananda is trying to explain here. So the case is similar to that of the chemicals used to take the dirt and alloy of gold. That's the glory of Vivekananda's interpretation of this particular sutra. Because you don't get such clear-cut explanations in the traditional Sanskrit commentaries because they were written centuries back. So the example is very, very illustrative. When the ore is melted down, the dross is burned along with the chemicals. So chemicals also should be got rid of if you want gold. The chemicals used to begin with to get rid of bad things associated with the golden ore. And once it is completely removed, what is left is gold. So that's something beyond description. Those good and evil tendencies will suppress each other. I mean, first, the good tendencies will neutralize evil tendencies, and then you will be able to ascend further and transcend both. Leaving alone the soul, the Atman, in its own splendor, untrammeled by either good or bad, the omnipresent, omnipotent, and omniscient. Then the man will know that he had neither birth nor death nor need for heaven or earth. So your yoga philosophy is converging on Vedanta. So Vivekananda's interpretation of Yoga Sutras, Raja Yoga, is a Vedantic interpretation. It is not exactly a yogi interpretation, because Vivekananda knew that yoga system is great only in its details,
because yoga system is essentially a dualistic system. Then he will know that he neither came or went. It was nature which was moving, and that movement was reflected upon the soul. So again, we have to come back to the philosophical, metaphysical structure of yoga, Sankhya system. You have to remember, just to understand this statement very well, the purpose is to get mastery over nature and then freedom from nature. What is nature? Nature is this phenomenal world, and also all the mental, intellectual, sensory faculties, tendencies, impressions, good and bad, all these are evolutes of prakriti, nature. So from prakriti, this is mahatattva, from its ahankara, mind emerges from sattva ahankara, then tendencies, impressions, senses of perception, senses of action, and then tanmatras, the subtle elements. From subtle elements, the gross elements, the phenomenal world, empirical world. So all these are really not our true nature. They do not constitute our true nature. So this prakriti or nature and all its evolutes, 23 evolutes, should be transcended. We should go beyond them. And when we go beyond them, then we will realize it is not Atman that is born and that dies. It is nature that goes through this evolution of birth, life, death, and rebirth. So with all of us, it is the Chitta constantly moving, making itself into various forms, and we think that we are these various forms. So the basic problem is, instead of identifying with what we actually are, with our true nature, we are identifying ourselves with all these foreign bodies. Foreign bodies means this, all the impressions, vasanas, vrittis, samskaras, tendencies that are responsible for our actions, that are responsible for all these confusions, waverings, anxieties. All these are alien to us. They do not constitute our true nature. Our true nature is something that's beyond all this. And how do you explain this? These are all different evolutes, different manifestations of nature. And once we dissociate ourselves through non-identification with nature, then we will realize that we are beyond all this. It is this non-identification with nature that makes us master of nature, not a slave of nature. And finally, when we transcend them, we get complete freedom from nature. That is an important point to remember. All these delusions will vanish when that free soul will command, not pray or beg, but command, then whatever it desires will be immediately fulfilled. So once we identify ourselves with our true nature, then we do not crave for anything, we don't have any desire for anything, then we are free. When so long as we have a desire for something, we are in a state of slavery. When we do not have any desire for anything, that is complete freedom. So desire is the sign of slavery, bondage. Desirelessness is freedom. That's why when we have to get something, when we want to achieve something, then we are not really free. That is the main objection of Vedanta with the creationist theory. See, if God creates this world for a purpose, then that God has something, he wants to do something. He has something to do. You may say you want to save the world, okay, but why should he have a desire to save the world? See, even to have a desire to do good things is good, certainly, no doubt. But then It is not a state of complete freedom. That's the idea behind it. When you transcend both, then you transcend even mastery. You do not have any desire for anything. That is why in Vedanta, creation is not like a pot maker making pot from clay, or a jewelry shopkeeper, or a goldsmith making golden ornaments from gold. Rather, it is the projection of the subtle in the projection of the subtle in gross form. The unmanifest, what you call avyakta in Vedantic language, manifests itself in names and forms. That's what we call the universe. And this universe, going back to its post-creation state, it's called dissolution. So the Sanskrit word for creation is srishti. Srishti is under the word sarga. Sarga is projection. Well, I'm not a physicist, of course, but all of you know, what was there before Big Bang? If you ask this question. So, there should have been something there from Big Bang. Otherwise, you have to admit from emptiness something comes out. From mere earth, a mango tree or a apple tree cannot come out. Only there should be something that should be there on earth. And you put water and manure, a sprout comes out. If there is a tree, it's a sure proof that it's coming from something else. So, the question is, if you ask the question, what was there before Big Bang? So before Big Bang, let's say Big Bang, you may, in Vedantic language, it is the manifestation of the subtle in names and forms, which becomes diverse. So maybe the cooling down of the universe, the created cosmos, then oxygen, then other lower organisms, amoeba, and slowly all the geographical, the climatic conditions become conducive for human existence and so on. It's a gradual evolution. But what was there before Big Bang? Before Big Bang, if Vedantin will tell you, before Big Bang, all these things were in unmanifest form. Unmanifest form means this kind of diversity in terms of names and forms and causations did not exist. So slowly, this multiple universe, this diverse phenomenal empirical universe emerged from the subtle form. And maybe after trillions of years, of course, some of us are trying to speed up the process. But let us say after trillions of years, if the cosmos goes back to its pre-manifestation stage. In Vedanta, it's called dissolution of pralaya. It means the gross going back its subtle form. It's like a tree going back to the seed form. Of course, in botany, it doesn't happen, but in philosophy, it is conceivable. The effect going back to cause. The gross going back to subtle. So creation is nothing but the gradual unfoldment of the subtle in gross form. And dissolution is nothing but this gross form going back to its causal subtle form. So the sarga and pratisarga, or srishti and pralaya, all these are different concepts, but these are all related to this. When it comes to nature, all these evolutes, 23 evolutes, our ego system, our tendencies, intellectual, mental faculties, 5 senses of perception, 5 senses of action, mind, all this emerges from nature. Once we take it back to its form through what we earlier discussed, reverse evolution, or we call involution. Evolution going backward. As I mentioned, explaining the effect and tracing effect to its cause. Then we transcend it. I can give a simple example for human life. This is a mighty philosophical doctrine, but it is a very simple form I can explain. Suppose somebody gets angry with you. Terribly angry. So you try to explain to him the cause of his anger. And once that reason, a rational explanation of the causes is made, then your anger is gone. Or you become depressed, or you become angry, or extremely excited, happy, or jubilant, or maybe extremely unhappy. Once we explain and understand, analyze this mental experience in the light of what was the cause of it, then you find it is gone. This is what happens. So maybe you may lose money, banks may collapse, creates problems, but then you sit quiet for some time and you understand the fact, well, it is nature of the bank to collapse. It is nature of the markets to come down and go up. The index may come down, it may go up. The wavering changeability is its nature. Once you try to philosophically analyze it, then you liberate yourself from that terrible mental agony, really speaking. So once you try to trace an effect to its cause by giving a rational explanation, then you are free from it. So what yoga is trying to do is, yoga is teaching us to explain the effects, and yoga is training us to trace the effect to its cause. And once we understand it, we are free from it. That's an idea behind. Then Swamiji says, all these delusions will vanish. Once we understand, all these delusions will vanish. And delusions can include both good and bad. Delusions are not always good, bad delusions. Good delusions also. So long as we have a natural inclination towards good, happy, always good, always enjoyable situations, then we will always be a prey, we'll fall victims to their opposites. That's what happens. So that's why we should transcend both. Then all these delusions will vanish. When that free soul will command, then we will attain complete mastery and complete freedom. So freedom is the goal of yoga. Freedom through mastery. So mastery over nature first, mastery over our own nature, not true nature, our secondary nature. Our true nature is that we are free, we are already inherently, by birth, we are free from it. But then we start identifying ourselves with all these evolutes of nature. And then we lose our freedom. We lose our mastery. Once we understand that this secondary nature is not our true nature is that we are ever free. Once we realize it, then we are liberated from the bondage of this second nature. So first nature, second nature, I shall already explain. First nature here implies our true self. If freedom is something that we get as a result of our spiritual practices, then that freedom cannot be everlasting. Anything that you get as a result of hard work cannot be everlasting. Because it is the effect of a cause. So it is subject to changes. But freedom is of true nature. So through mastery over nature, we are rediscovering our true nature, which is that we are always free. So it is actually a returning to our own home, our own true nature. We are by nature free. That's our real nature, first nature. We are free. But then through wrong identification with all these empirical, wavering, changeable, worldly experiences, happiness, unhappiness, joy, sorrow, and so on, we lose our true identity with our true nature, that we are free, and we get a wrong identity through wrong identification with this wrong second nature. That is prakriti and its evolutions, tendencies, vasanas, vrittis, samskaras, impressions, goodness, badness, happiness, unhappiness, and so on, which are really not our true nature. So in yoga, you are not getting something new. You are actually getting back what is actually yours. You are actually coming back to your home, which you by mistake left long back. Which you are really coming back. That's why freedom is eternal. Freedom is not the result of any effort. So one very important doctrine of Shankaracharya is Mokshasya Akaryatvat, which means liberation, freedom, spiritual freedom is not the effect of any cause. It is not a result of our spiritual practices. Our spiritual practices remove the obstacles which stand in our way of identifying ourselves with our true nature, our free nature. And once those obstacles are gone, then we are what we actually are. So, actually we are not gaining, attaining something. We are actually regaining, rediscovering. We are actually getting back to our true nature. So that is a very, very important principle in yoga and Vedanta. So, so now we will go to the 19th sutra. 19th sutra deals with some liberated souls. There are different categories of enlightened persons, enlightened souls in yoga tradition. Bhava pratyayo videha prakriti layanam. This is a sutra. So those who have reached a state of transcendence, they are like some divine entities holding certain high offices. So it is a reference to one important doctrine and one important belief in Vedanta and yoga. That is, those who have done a lot of spiritual practice, they also get samadhi, and they are able to liberate themselves from the embodiment. It's called prakriti laya. I mean, they are already merged in prakriti. They are highly evolved, advanced spiritual seekers, but they don't belong to the highest category of free souls. So this is a little beside the point we are discussing. What it means is, according to yoga tradition, those who have died after doing a lot of spiritual practices, they get freedom from their physical embodiment in the sense that they are not born again as human beings or as embodied beings, but they have not reached the highest state of liberation. They have to go beyond that. In yoga tradition, Vedanta tradition, what we call angels, let us say it may be more or less parallel to Christian tradition, angels, highly evolved souls who are quite advanced in spiritual life because of their constant spiritual practices. So they have attained freedom from their total identification with this physical nature, as ordinary human beings are. They are beyond that. So they are called devas. Devas actually means those who are living in celestial regions. That's the meaning of deva. So one of our famous interpretation of Vedic mantras called Niruktam. Niruktam is almost like a thesaurus. It belongs to maybe 9th century BC, around 8th or 9th century BC. So there was a great it's lexicographer. It is supposed to be the first attempt at lexicography, like a dictionary. Dictionary or a thesaurus is something like that. It reads almost like a definition. You know, for example, I can quote from Devo Danadva Deepanadva Dyotanava Dusthanova Bhavati Di. This is, I'm just quoting for you. It's not a, may not be easily understand, intelligible. I shall explain. Who is Deva? He's mentioned here. Devo Danadva. Either he is one, a divine angel, a divine being, an advanced person living in the celestial regions we call heaven. They are those who listen to your prayers and give you what you pray for, long life, wealth, and so on. It's a definition. More or less like angels in Christian tradition. So that's one. Another one is Dusthanava. They are living in celestial regions. Deepanadva, they live in your heart and illumine you. So there are three, four meanings given to the word deva. I'm just giving an example. So those who reach a kind of asamprajnata samadhi, or sometimes samprajnata samadhi, they reach a state of videha or prakriti laya. They transcend the state of physical embodiment, but at the same time they don't get complete freedom. After living for thousands of years somewhere in some other celestial regions, they are born again. If you go to some Hindu mythological books, I'm not going to detail that, you find they say these devas are living in other galaxies, and maybe modern science is trying to explore the possibility of living beings living in other planets. We do not know. Anyway, if there are living beings in other planets, certainly their skills, faculties, and their concept of years will be different. See, what do you think of people who live in planets which are, let's say, closer to sun? So their 1 year will be much less than 365 days. Or those who are living farther away. So you find in the mythological books, Hindu mythological books, you say for devas, they live tens of thousands of years. So tens of thousands of years is like 1 day for them. Our 1,000 years is like 1 day for them. So you find such concepts. These are, what I'm trying to explain is, yoga and Sankhya philosophy speak of these advanced spiritual seekers who are free from physical embodiment as we are, and who are living in celestial regions, who after living for several thousands of years are born again as human beings to continue the spiritual journey till they reach complete freedom. This idea, that's the meaning here. Bhava pratyayo videha prakriti layana. That's why bhava pratyaya means they have to be born again. So in Hindu mythology, Vedantic mythology also, heaven is not a very big achievement, or celestial region is not a big achievement. You may have wonderful life there, but you are born again and you have to continue your spiritual practices till you transcend all these physical embodiments till you attain complete freedom from this wrong identification with natural phenomena. That's the idea behind. So next sutra is very important. Saddha, Virya, Smriti, Samadhi, Prajna, Purvaka, Idaresham. Now, in this sutra, 20th sutra, we are discussing the nature of real yogis, those who have reached Asamprajnata Samadhi through proper spiritual practice. So without becoming Prakriti Laya Purushas, what we call, without becoming these transcendental angelic beings who are destined to be born again because they are not at complete freedom, these real yogis, the Idaresham means those real advanced yogis who do not belong to the category explained in the earlier sutra, 19th sutra. What are their characteristics? Shraddha, Virya, Smriti, Samadhi, Prajna. These are their qualities. So that needs explanation. So what is the nature of those who have attained real freedom? These are the qualities. Shraddha, that is faith, energy, memory, concentration, and discrimination. Mean discerning mind, that's the meaning of the real. So we shall explain this. Shraddha, that's very important. Those who are completely free from these natural bondages, this slavish inclination towards natural phenomena, enjoyments, pleasure, and things like that. Those who are completely free from all these, one important characteristic is Shraddha. Shraddha is really a clear outlook. Total freedom from conflict or doubt. That is the natural characteristic of those who have reached complete freedom, attained complete freedom through proper Asamprajnata Samadhi, higher concentration. Now, this is equally important for a beginner in yoga. So, what is natural? What is characteristic of advanced yogis is a necessary discipline for the beginner. So Shraddha actually means it's external sign. I mean, if you want to judge a person whether he has got Shraddha or not, he will be completely free from conflicts or doubt. How do we attain this freedom from conflict? So one important aspect of the Shraddha is a sense of sanctity and sacredness, which will give us the feeling, well, this is the yoga, this Vedanta, or this meditation, this devotional spiritual practice is something sacred, something I should consider to be sacred, something, when you consider something as sacred, then you don't have a doubt about it. At the intellectual level, you are rationally analyzing whether it's the right thing or wrong thing. There, the concentration will be only maximum 99%. Even the most advanced student or a scientist who is still at the level of intellectual analysis or rational analysis won't be able to concentrate his full attention on what he or she is doing if that person does not have Shraddha. Because Shraddha makes your concentration 100%. Because you attach a degree of sacredness and sanctity to what you do. There is no doubt for you. So that is one important quality of Shraddha. In its external from an external point of view, total freedom from conflict, doubt, or hesitation may be some of the characteristics of a person who has got Shraddha. But its most important element, which gives you complete freedom from doubt and conflict is a sense of sanctity and sacredness. That's why when we read a great spiritual work, and if you're trying to intellectually analyze whether it's right, whether it's proper or not, then we will miss something. It's something like, you know, if you want to lit a candle from another lamp, that candle and a flame should come together. There cannot be a millimeter gap between a wick that you are holding in your hand and the burning candle. So the flame should touch, without a millimeter gap, the flame should touch the wick. Then only the flame will be transferred from one burning lamp to another one. And once it is done, they are the same, because the flame has got the same quality. So like that, this Shraddha enables us to approach and understand gradually something with total concentration, with total freedom from conflict and doubt. So that becomes natural. It's not something that you try to practice. It becomes an inherent natural quality of a yogi. So that is Shraddha, Virya, Smriti, Samadhi, Prajna. We will discuss this one after another in the next session. Thank you. So we will have interaction now, maybe for about 10 minutes.
P-R-A-N-A. He was saying you see something and it was kind of like having complete control over the world. Is that the type of consciousness?
Could you explain this?
It was in a book written by
Vivekananda.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
He was talking about seeing the world for what it was. And it was, because you're talking about that complete consciousness and having complete control.
Yeah, yeah.
He called it prana. And when you see the world, which is a pranayana or pranayama, he was talking about some type of complete control that just seemed beyond me.
Well, yeah, and I understand.
I'm wondering what is meant by that, and is it attainable?
Yeah.
You know, well, because you're talking about going beyond the mind, and I feel my problem is my mind is always in the problem.
Exactly. Yeah. So what Vivekananda is talking about is the cosmic energy.
Yeah.
So normally we identify ourselves with our individual energy, prana, individual energy.
Yeah. Okay.
Individual energy is only an individual dimension of the cosmic universal prana.
Yeah, yeah.
So once we transcend this individual dimension through samadhi, through practice, then you connect with this cosmic prana, cosmic energy.
Mm-hmm.
Once you do that, you become one with it.
Okay.
So it requires a lot of meditation, a lot of concentration. So we at first, through constant practice, we should be able to attain absolute, complete tranquility of mind.
Mm-hmm.
So that our individual prana becomes completely controlled, stabilized, in state of complete equilibrium and tranquility. Once that is attained, then you will understand the individual prana that constitutes your vital energy is not different or distinct from the cosmic all-pervading energy.
Okay.
So this identification is a natural result of yogic practice. Once you do that, you get complete freedom. So those who reach this state of complete freedom, they will not have any desire. Mm. They will not have any such desire. In fact, to attain this transcendental identification with the cosmic all-pervading prana, one should practice absolute and complete renunciation. It's called paravairagya.
Yeah.
That's an important step. Through this step, If you reach that state, then you know what happens. Then you won't be you will not have any desire to attain mastery, attain control anybody. And as a an extended explanation, mm-hmm. you find many people who try to influence people
yeah.
through this prana. It happens. It could happen even through devotional practices also, prayer, long mm-hmm. prayers. Mm-hmm. People attain some kind of mental skill, intellectual, psychic skill, and then they want to attain, they want to achieve many things, which shows that they have not reached that stage through proper means.
Mm.
They have, it's almost like, a naturally violent person. If he goes to gymnasium, he becomes a very powerful fellow. He becomes a small town gunda, hooligan, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So like that, people who develop this kind of high skills, they become a big problem, a big curse for humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Because these skills can be used. And you find in the whole history of humanity, you find people who demonstrated great powers of mind, great powers of concentration. They may have, maybe from a yoga point of view, they may have practiced some of these skills in their previous life.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they are born with these great faculties, but they have not attained, they have not reached this state through the path of renunciation,
mm-hmm.
through the path of mastery over nature. They wanted to control nature, so they have reached the skills, but they have not attained freedom. So what happens, yoga says, such people who develop these skills, who demonstrate these skills, they have to come back to normal human level and start their journey from spiritual kindergarten again, mm-hmm. and they're born again. That's what he says. That's why, you know, it is the verse which I read, you know, this bhava pratyo videha prakritilayanam, prakritilaya, these are some kind of celestial beings. Some of them are great. Some of these skills also can come to people who are not completely got freedom from evil tendencies.
Yeah.
When they get these skills, they display those evil. If you read some of the extraordinary feats of mind that you find in people like Genghis Khan, examples you find yeah. in world history, you find superhuman powers of mind, which normally you don't find. Of course, another example, according to some, is I don't fully believe, but there's a Hitler is one example.
Yeah, well, I was thinking,
man
was
could sway tens of thousands of people by his words, you know.
Yeah.
People could not say no to him. So what was in him? He was... So such people, from a yoga analysis, mm-hmm. such people may have attained some skills through some kind of practice, but they did not take care to practice yamas, niyamas, self-restraint, self-control, renunciation.
Mm-hmm.
All these qualities that give you not only this power, but also to understand the limitation of this power and the wisdom not to use these powers for wrong purposes, for evil purposes.
Okay.
Jesus Christ was a real yogi. You yeah. find the old temple, you can see a picture of, you know, the founder of the old temple,
mm-hmm.
you know, Swami Tirunadidananda, Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ had all these great powers, but he used for the good of the world. He was a blessing for the world. So Buddha, all these great men, Buddha or Jesus or Shankaracharya,
yeah.
Ramakrishna, you find Vivekananda recent times. So these great men, they have attained great powers of mind and psychic concentration. But they work for the good of the world. They give so many blessings to the world. You can find the opposite example which I quoted just now. So what yoga says is, they say, already we stated again, before anyone takes up any of these higher spiritual practices like asana,
mm-hmm.
pranayama, pratyahara, means higher concentration, dhyana, samadhi, one should get completely established one should get completely be established. Yamas and niyamas, non-violence, purity, total freedom from desire, contentment, a sense of resignation to God's will, and inner and outer purity. All these spiritual qualities will become natural to a spiritual seeker. When they reach this samadhi level, these skills they will get, but along with that, they also get the wisdom, the spiritual wisdom, to use them for the blessings of the humanity.
For appropriate reasons.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that's the idea. Okay.
Well, I feel like my mind zigzags between what is right and chaos all the time.
Yeah.
So I'm not quite free.
But. So that's why before we, and we always insist on this point, this yogic concentration should not be practiced by people who do not have a lot of free time. I'm talking about higher concentration. Don't mean the yoga is something scary. Don't misunderstand that. What it means is higher skills, higher mental concentration should not be practiced unless we are able to practice some important discipline, spiritual, moral discipline, like non-violence, total freedom from selfishness, inner purity, self-control. All these are essential disciplines before we take up these things. That's an important point. So we can continue the discussion. I want to clarify, next week there is class? Next Thursday? We do have? Okay. Next week. So, okay. So, we'll continue discussion again next session. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.